Great, thanks very much, Celia Vardin. So I've got a title for my talk, No Elephant in the Room. Three ways of denying the self. So broadly, I want to take a perspective which is perhaps complementary to Celia Vardin's, in rather than asking what is the self, asking what do Buddhists mean when they deny the self, assuming that this is what Buddhists often do or are said to do. So a story which I'm sure you might all have versions of, because I was once at the Manchester Buddha Centre. This is about 1993. I got put up at the community above the centre during a weekend event. And after the washing up, I was in conversation with a young man. And he began to tell me that the no-self doctrine was very important to him. If only I could see, he said, if only I could see that there isn't a self, I would be free. There would be this kind of liberation. I can't remember his exact words, but what I can remember is his look of longing and a kind of passionate involvement with this idea. And yet I felt very worried as I heard him speak. I was perhaps not quite confident enough to say anything, but it sounded nihilistic to me, as if he was taking the not-self teaching to mean that if only one could no longer be the person one thinks one is, one would achieve the promised kind of happiness that goes with awakening. So is this true? Is this true? This is the question. So that's a question. And also, more recently, in the course of the development of insight, inquiry in the order, and in the world at large, liberation unleashed, and so on, one hears more about the self is an illusion. There is no self. And again, associated with a sort of liberating insight. So this is not... This question of what does it mean to deny the self is quite relevant for us as Western Buddhists. What are we trying to do? And I'm not going to say anything that's critical about that process, you know, the insight inquiry process, but only about how it's put. Does that make sense? This is a philosophical kind of discussion about how we use words to communicate what we take to be the truth. So in a way, it's a quite practical question. What do we mean when we deny the self? And practically, how do we avoid nihilism in how we put it? So I'm going to give a talk in four parts. We had four parts last night, didn't we? So again, four parts. Firstly, I want to do the obvious thing and go back to early Buddhist kind of discourses to see, well, what was the Buddha reported to have said about the not-self teaching? How did he present it? And I'm going to argue that in a very crucial way, it's not clear what it means. There you go. And then, so this is, therefore, as you can imagine, this will become the basis for Buddhists ever since discussing this question of what does it mean to deny the self and coming to very different conclusions. I think this is important for how we think about what it means now to talk about the self. I mean, Buddhists have argued about this since the beginning of Buddhism, and we're part of that process, as it were. In the second part of my talk, I'll turn to the chariot argument, which purports to show there's no self. Yeah, so it's a kind of Buddhist version of a hard reductionist argument. And I'm going to also share Chandrakirti's way of completely undermining it. It'll become apparent that Chandrakirti's become a bit of a hero of mine. I've got very keen on his point of view. Chandrakirti is a Madhyamaka philosopher from India of the 6th century, Madhyamaka belonging to the Middle Way school that was founded by Nagarjuna. In the third part of my talk, I'll turn to the Yogacara philosophy of Vasubandhu, which is, we've heard a bit about it. It's an approach which puts forward an elaborate phenomenological descriptive account of how the self appears, of how it manifests as a transformation of consciousness and in consciousness. Nevertheless, there is an element of reductionism in showing how all this is a transformation within non-dual awareness. Very attractive argument, this. Very different from a reductive approach to say there's no self. But fourthly, last part, hope we get there and you're not too exhausted, I'm going to turn to Chandrakirti's Madhyamaka approach, which doesn't posit anything, doesn't make any claims, just draws out the significance of starting from the point of view that everything arises dependent on conditions, and the idea that something can exist without depending on conditions, can exist independently, doesn't make sense. And if you get this, you just get that the self doesn't exist as it appears to exist. So it's a non-reductionist approach to showing what's meant by denying the self. That's already going to sound a bit almost mystical, but we'll see how we get on. So you'll see that in the background, I think Chandrakirti's got it right, but I'm hoping to do justice to the other approaches so you can decide for yourself. So, firstly, non-self in the early discourses. You'd think it might be straightforward to find out what the Buddha said about not-self, but of course, as it turns out, there's an enormous mass of materials which says all sorts of things. But it's possible to make some observations about the Buddha's teaching on non-self, just picking on some really interesting discourses, which is in a sense also a kind of choice about how I present it. Firstly, non-self, the Buddha teaches not-self in the sense of denying a metaphysical self. So there's a discourse called To Ananda. The Buddha doesn't talk to a wanderer called Vachagata. So this non-Buddhist wanderer comes up to the Buddhist and says, Mr. Gotama, is there a self, an Atman? When this was said, the Blessed One remained silent. Mr. Gotama, is there not a self? A second time, the Blessed One remained silent. And Vachagata, the wanderer, got up and left. Then Ananda asks the Buddha, why, Lord, did you not answer Vachagata's questions? Ananda, had I been asked by Vachagata, the wanderer, is there a self, answered that the self exists, that would have been to agree with those ascetics and brahmanas who are eternalists, a kind of those who hold a robust sense of self. Ananda, had I, being asked by Vachagata the Wanderer, is there not a self, answered that the self does not exist, that would have been to agree with those ascetics and brahmanas who are annihilationists, who presumably would be hard reductionists of some sort. Ananda, had I, being asked by Vachagata the Wanderer, is there a self, answered that the self does exist, would that be consonant with the arising of the knowledge that all phenomena are without self? This is a famous saying, isn't it? All phenomena are without self. Sabedama anatta. Certainly not, Lord. Ananda, had I, being asked by Vachagata the Wanderer, is there not a self, answered that the self does not exist, wouldn't the bewildered wanderer of Vatchagotta be even more confused, thinking, I used to have a self, but now it doesn't exist?
I wonder where I left it.
This exchange must always have produced a smile for people, I think. So it shows the Buddha explaining to Ananda that his reason for neither affirming nor denying the self was not to mislead Vatchagotta into thinking that the Buddha taught a speculative view or a metaphysical theory about the self. Let's call this a metaphysical self, an idea about what the self really is. And so the Buddha doesn't say that the self is an illusion, but only that to either affirm or to deny it would be to put forward an idea about the self, a metaphysical kind of theory. And I think more analytically, the reason the Buddha didn't affirm or deny an idea of the self, the metaphysical self, is that like the son of a barren woman, to use this expression, or the horns of a hare, to use this expression, such a thing does not exist. Such a thing is non-existent. So a self which is like the referent or the object of a theory about the self just doesn't exist. It's a non-existent sort of entity. And elsewhere, I say that because elsewhere the Buddha argues that views about the metaphysical self are just thoughts that arise on condition of feeling and craving. So their content being simply a sort of overstimulated speculation, you could say. A kind of narrative, sort of supercharged narrative, I suppose. It just doesn't refer to anything. So the Buddha denies the metaphysical self by arguing it's non-existent rather than an illusion. And in fact, the Buddha argues that views of this sort should just be given up. And the reason here is important. So in discussion with another wanderer, a bit more intelligent this one, called Potapada, who wants to know all about what does the Buddha teach about the self, and especially about cessation. The Buddha says, Potapada, there are three kinds of assumed self. There's an obvious assumed self. There's a mind-made assumed self and a non-physical assumed self. So by describing these selves as assumed, or the word patilabha can mean acquired, that the Buddha implies that they are ideas about the self corresponding to ideas about the spiritual life. So to say that the obvious self is assumed, well, for someone who talks about the obvious self, as it were, being real, that's just to affirm ordinary experience. Somebody who holds the view that there's a mind-made assumed self is perhaps somebody who holds that the obvious self is not really the case, but that through spiritual practice we can discover a self through meditation, through deeply concentrated states of meditation, in which the mind is released, as it were, from the body, and cruises in a sort of imaginal realm of archetypal form, you could say. And similarly, we could think that the non-physical, the arupi, or the formless assumed self, is the self that's posited by people who are familiar with the formless attainments, the sphere of infinite space and consciousness, sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, really refined states of mind. But the Buddha goes on, Potapada, I teach the Dharma for the sake of abandoning the obvious self, the mind-made self, and the formless, assumed self. The defiled qualities of those who have practiced like this will be abandoned. The purified qualities will increase. And, having realized it through their own direct knowledge in the here and now, they will enter and dwell in the fulfillment and full development of understanding. So the Buddha teaches that the giving up of any views about the self as a sort of metaphysical entity, an idea about the self, is a really positive thing. Instead, we should pay attention to the development of wholesome states for the achievement of understanding. This is very typical of the Buddha's whole style of teaching, we can say. It's very practical, oriented towards the development of the wholesome. But then the Buddha goes on to say something really very interesting. As to all this talk of the self that goes on in human discourse, very generally, he says, this is also to Potapada, this talk, these are designations, words, expressions and concepts in ordinary speech with which the realised one expresses himself without taking them literally. So the Buddha seems quite capable, he seems quite positive about using words that relate to the self, words like I and me and myself, but he doesn't take them literally. So that's all relatively clear, but turning now to another way the Buddha teaches, in the third sermon, the Buddha presents the first five disciples with arguments which they should take into their meditation, which assume that experience can be explained in terms of the five constituents, the five skandhas or khandhas, the physical body, feeling tone, perceptions, habits and dispositions, the sankhara, and consciousness. So firstly, one doesn't have control over these five constituents. So the self can't be the kind of inner controller that might count as a self that's worth having. And secondly, these constituents are impermanent and unsatisfactory. They can't give us full satisfaction, partly because they're impermanent, such that it would hardly be fitting to regard them as me or mine or myself. And it's said that seeing like this, a disciple becomes disenchanted and dispassionate about the constituents and gains liberation. So the Buddha's attention in these arguments seems to be to the me and the mine and the myself of experience, of an experiential self of some sort, what we normally experience as the self, which takes us now into the realm of what Siddhartha was talking about yesterday. We could imagine somebody who even holds the two-tier kind of model of self, the Buddha presenting these arguments to that person. In other discourses, these constituents, the psychophysical processes, are described as upadana khanda, masses of appropriation, heaps of appropriation. So clinging or appropriation, upadana, is the making one's own of the psychophysical processes which make up experience. And the Buddha describes this appropriation as arising dependent on beginningless ignorance and craving. I mean, obviously you can't prove that, it's just a way of kind of evoking what our experience is like. And the most important feature of appropriation is the belief in the self, the belief that the experiential self is real. The appearance in awareness of this self is the sense of I am, as well as thoughts about the past and the future. This narrative self, you could say, that arise through the processes of proliferation or papancha. So another quote, I am is a proliferation. I am this is a proliferation. I shall be is a proliferation, which means a kind of automatic or unwilled process of thinking which you believe in. And the process underlying the proliferation of these thoughts is ego identification, ahankara, I-making, which arises dependent on the underlying tendencies or anusaya of the mind to ignorance, to sense pleasures, to craving and views. So the aim of the Buddhist life becomes the calming of proliferation and the giving up of appropriation, which is obviously a gradual process through insight and meditation. So the training results in a radical alteration of the ordinary and familiar sense of self and its replacement by a direct awareness of causation or dependent arising as the basic way in which experience works. And something of this flavour of this change is suggested by this the following short discourse. The Buddha says, monks, a practitioner's consideration of six consequences, of good consequences, will quite suffice to establish in them the generalised perception of non-self in all the constituents of experience. So what six good consequences? I will not identify with anything in the world. All my ego identification will cease. All my identification with me and mine will cease. I will gain unique knowledge. I will have seen causation well. That means dependent arising. And I will have seen causally arisen elements of experience. So the perception of non-self here, the anatta sanya, is described not in terms of a denial of the self or in terms of the self being an illusion, but in terms of a different kind of experience, one that's no longer characterised by appropriation or proliferation concerning I or me or the self. So our big question is, well, what does this mean for the self, if you see what I mean? Are we then right to conclude, oh, there is no self, and leave it as a blank, as it were, or that the self is an illusion? And the reason this is unclear is because awakened beings continue to appear to inhabit a first person or subjective stance in the world. They distinguish themselves from others just like everybody else, and they use personal pronouns and linguistic expressions referring to themselves in a way that's completely like everybody else. Although they do say they're not confused about how they use it. So the arahant, the worthy one, is described as follows. This is a set of verses, that's why it sounds a bit funny. That wise one has overcome the belief in their own thoughts. They might say, I say such and such. They might say, they said this to me. They are experts in the ordinary. They know the common language. They might use such words, but to communicate, not more. Goodness, what does this mean? What does it mean?
Fantastic.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah. So they can use these words like really well. That's the point. But what does it mean? Do they don't believe in them exactly. But so what is it? What's going on there as regards to the self? And here's the difficulty in presenting the non-self teaching. The Dharma implies that a metaphysical self, an idea about the self, is simply non-existent. But the Dharma also involves giving up ego identification through insight into the non-self character of experience. But this insight doesn't mean that one doesn't refer to I and me. And in fact, it seems just like everybody else in that sense. So maybe, in short, it's hard to understand the Dharma. The Buddha said it. So now, second part of my talk. So I'm more or less on time, isn't that okay? I'm going to turn now to an argument made in support of the idea that there is no self. This is the chariot argument. So we find this chariot argument set out in the Melinda Panha. So this is this means the questions of King Melinda. It's an anonymous work. You could say it's a work of philosophy, but not in a technical sense, kind of popular philosophy. And it's an anonymous post-canonical work preserved in the Pali language, but it was probably written in North India and not in Pali, because it concerns the conversations of a monk called Nagasena with King Melinda, who is based on the historical figure of King Menander, who reigned over a Bactrian Greek kingdom, which is right in the northeast of the Indian subcontinent. And he reigned during the 2nd century BCE. The Greeks arrived with Alexander and then took over these kingdoms for centuries. Isn't that amazing? So King Melinda approaches Nagasena and asks who he is. The monk replies that he is called Nagasena. But this is a concept, an expression, a mere name, since, in this respect, a person is not to be found. You can see where this is going, can't you? So the king, who is presented as a very bright kind of interlocutor, non-Buddhist interlocutor, goes on to ask Nagasena, so who is it that practices ethics? And who experiences the results of karma, if no person is to be found? The monk doesn't actually answer this, but in turn asks King Melinda whether is Nagasena his heir? He didn't use the word my, but he's talking about himself. Are the nails, teeth and bones and the other parts of the body, are they Nagasena? Or is physical form or feeling tone or perceptions or the habits and dispositions or consciousness, are they Nagasena? And the king denies that any of these constituents or khandhas is Nagasena. So the monk concludes that Nagasena is just a sound and no Nagasena can be found. Nagasena then goes on to ask the king how he arrived there. He came by chariot. So, and is this chariot in which he arrived, is it the pole or the axle or the wheels or the frame or the flagpole of the chariot? They all seem to have flagpoles. Again, no. The chariot isn't any of those parts. Therefore, chariot is just a sound. And the king is lying, for no chariot can be found. And the text continues, showing that King Melinda is sort of on the case with this kind of dialectic here. Nagasena, good sir, I do not speak falsely. That which is called a chariot exists by convention as a concept, an expression, a mere name, dependent on a pole, an axle, wheels, a frame, and a flagpole. So it exists by convention. Nagasena says, excellent, Your Majesty, you understand a chariot. Likewise, Your Majesty, in my case, that which is called Nagasena exists by convention, dependent on the body parts, the constituents, and so on. And then he goes on to say, this is the bit that's particularly important. In this respect, a person in the ultimate sense is not to be found. Your Majesty, Vajra the nun said this just in the presence of the Blessed One. Now he quotes Vajra the nun who came up with the chariot argument. Just as from an arrangement of parts, there is that for which we have the word chariot. Likewise, when the constituents exist, there is what we call a person. The king says, extraordinary, Nagasena, good sir, marvellous, good sir. You have answered the questions put to you brilliantly. If Nagasena were here, if the Buddha were here, he would applaud you. Excellent. You've answered these questions really brilliantly. Ati citram. But how brilliantly has Nagasena really answered the king? I'm now going to analyse this argument a bit. Let's rehearse it. So, this will work. I think it might help if I write it. So, if I write it from here and then I'll move. Yeah. Premise one. A chariot is made of parts. Premise two. Something made of parts is merely a name. Yeah, something that's made up of parts is just a name. It doesn't exist apart from those parts. So, conclusion. Chariot is the name for an assembly of parts. Does that sound okay as an argument to you? A chariot is made of parts. Something made of parts is merely a name. Therefore, a chariot is merely a name.
It's valid.
Thank you.
It's not sound.
So it's formally valid. Right. You say it's not sound, so we'll come back to this. So now, premise three. What is called a person is made of parts. And then, second conclusion. A person, you can fill it in there, can't you? A person is merely a name. So I'll call that a self. So it's a logically valid argument, so it seems to me anyway, that rests on this analogy between a chariot and a person. If you accept that a chariot is like a person, then this is a valid argument. But actually, the argument that Nagasena, the conclusion that Nagasena comes to is that no person in the ultimate sense exists. Yeah? So self is merely a name and no person in the ultimate sense exists. When we look at the verses that Nagasena quotes, that they come from the Pali Canon, in the context, Vajra the nun utters them in response to Mara. Mara's asked this nun, who's meditating in seclusion, some hair-raising existential questions about who she is. Where does she come from? Where is she going? What's it all about? She'd replied to Mara by uttering this verse. Just as from an arrangement of parts, there is that for which we have the word chariot. Likewise, when the constituents exist, there is what we call a person. And by appealing to that, she'd seen off Mara, who'd been tempting her into the view that there's a person who exists, who she could worry about, who's come from somewhere, who's going somewhere else, and who exists in the moment. But in context, this is sort of methodological. A spiritual practitioner like Vajra had already established in herself the perception of non-self in awareness, as it were. And the argument for this merely non-nominal, non-ultimate existence of the person was a kind of reminder of the non-existence of the metaphysical self. Yeah, she was using the argument to remind herself, look, it's okay. There isn't a self apart from, there isn't a metaphysical self, an idea of the self that exists apart from the constituents. And it wasn't really anything like a rehearsal of the arguments that you'd need to perceive the not-self characteristic of experience. So it's quite delicate, this, isn't it? So although it follows completely logically that self is merely a name, would it be the case that anybody studying this argument would really see how the self comes to be in their experience? That's the question. Does that make sense? It's methodological, I'm wondering about. There's an English bhikkhu, Jnana Vira, who wrote an important book called Clearing the Path, who discusses this. And he makes the point that if you accept this argument, the unwary thinker comes to believe that he understands what, in fact, he does not understand, and thereby effectively blocks his own progress. Wow. And now Chandrakirti, who I'll introduce properly in a bit, had made a similar point about Nagasena's argument some centuries before. He makes the point that while one may understand the non-existence of the metaphysical self, this permanent self that exists as an idea, once one has come to understand the non-self characteristic of experience, you'll see that the metaphysical self, this idea of the self, was never the basis of ego identification. It never was the problem. So seeing that it doesn't exist won't help you. It can't help you. And I think he seems to mock Nagasena, actually, who King Milinda had said it argued brilliantly. He says, this is a Chandrakirti now, when there is an understanding of non-self, a permanent self is rejected. But that permanent self should not be regarded as the basis of ego identification. One who says that they've uprooted it, that means ego identification, from their own view, by knowing the non-existence of the permanent self, they really speak brilliantly, he says. So it seems to be an ironic take on Nagasena. Then there's a comparison. Chandrakirti says, supposing that seeing a snake which has gone into a hole in one's own home, one removes one's terror by saying, there is no elephant there. And by doing that, one also manages to abandon the fear that arises because of the snake. Well, that would be really naive. That's what he says. It's a great argument, isn't it? So the point is, you can kind of, without much difficulty, prove there's no elephant in the room. Yeah? But surely it's silly to suppose that disproving the existence of the elephant will help anyone allay the very real difficulties of having a snake living in your house. I mean, I suppose it's a poisonous one. That is the unsatisfactoriness that comes from appropriating and proliferating the experiential self. So it turns out that Nagasena's chariot argument, it works. It's a reductionist argument that works by conflating the permanent metaphysical self with the experiential self. An idea about the self and the actual experience in a way which obscures the significance of investigating the non-self characteristic. In fact, you could see Nagasena as encouraging people to take up an annihilationist view. Couldn't you? That there's no permanent self, which that by necessity you'd understand as saying there's no experiential self. And so in that sense it's connected with a sort of hard reductionist approach to the self. So much for the chariot argument. You don't have to agree with me. I've just put that argument forward for your consideration, as it were, and raised Chandrakirti's objections to it. It'd be really good, you know, if a hard reductionist type would defend it. But we'll see. Perhaps the chariot argument is a bit of a straw man argument. Maybe that's part of how it works. It sets up a straw man, the permanent metaphysical self, which it then knocks down, bonk, very easy, it's just straw, to leave the experiential self just untouched. As his philosophers talk about straw man arguments. So let's now turn to a very different kind of argument for the denial of the self. And it's the argument developed in the course of Vasubandhu's Trinshika, his 30 verses on representation only, which argues that the self is an error. It's a cognitive error. He doesn't say that it's an illusion or that it doesn't exist. He says it's a mistake. So this argument, it is reductionist. It's a reductionist argument. But it seeks to show that what we think of the self, think of as the self, is really something else. But it's a sort of soft reductionist argument, because what you end up with is quite amazing. If you see what I mean, what you're left with is non-dual awareness, rather than brain states. So the self is a psychological process. Well, what we think of as the self is a psychological process that gives rise to the erroneous appearance of a self. So Vasubandhu is one of the great figures in Buddhist philosophy. He started out as an Abhidharma philosopher. He wrote a big commentary called the Abhidharma Kosha, the commentary on the treasury of knowledge, which is his own account of Abhidharma.
Sorry, could you just tell me how you spell his name?
Oh, Vasubandhu, thank you, yes. Vasubandhu. But he's said to have converted to Mahayana under the influence of his brother, Asanga. And he then composed some very dense poetic texts exploring, setting out the Yogacara viewpoint, which is a Mahayana Buddhist philosophical viewpoint, you could say. The basic tenet is called Vijñapti Matra. Which means representation only. By saying it's a tenet, it's a way of summarising the philosophy, is to say that the appearance to consciousness of mind-independent objects. So right now, you're aware of carpet, walls, my voice, various objects of your experience. The appearance of these objects as independent of the mind is fundamentally an appearance of duality within a real but non-dual awareness in which they manifest. That's the tenet, as it were. So it sounds a bit like idealism, but it's not really. So actually, even now, it's not so difficult to see what this means. So you know that when you just take your attention to the visual sense, you can see people, you can see a table, and so on. And these are just given. These perceptions are given as being referring to objects that are there. Is that right? Independent of the mind. And yet you can ask yourself, well, how do I know that they're independent of my mind? Yeah? I mean, we're not doubting that they are. We're just wondering, how do we know it? And the way we know it is by the by the objects of our visual experience right now appearing as objects to us as subjects, so as a duality within experience. So you can either assume that duality is real, or, well, but that leads to all sorts of big problems. What is the self? What is the external world? How do you know anything about it? Or you can explain it in a completely different way by explaining how this whole manifestation of duality arises within consciousness. And that's what the Yogacharans try to do. It's a neat trick if you can do it, isn't it? You can imagine. I think there's a comparison to be made between Yogacara and the phenomenology of Edmund Husserl. He cropped up last night, yeah? As the founder of phenomenology. Husserl. And, I mean, Husserl's phenomenology is oriented towards knowledge, towards a kind of, not science particularly, but the kind of Western philosophical goal of true knowledge. Whereas Yogacara is oriented towards the Buddhist goal of liberation and awakening. So different kind of approaches. But the similarity is that the starting point, Husserl characterises the everyday viewpoint of the average person as the natural attitude. The natural attitude, a kind of naive realism, which is perceived by... which is based on the unreflective assumption of the existence of an external world perceived by a conscious subject or self who continues through time. That's just our ordinary everyday assumption about what it means to have experience. External world of objects, internal self who continues through time. But according to Husserl, to gain any kind of philosophical knowledge of reality, one needs to carry out a phenomenological reduction, deciding to bracket or suspend one's assumptions, to commit yourself to an inquiry into the conditions for experience, which makes any knowledge possible. Otherwise, there's all sorts of massive philosophical questions about how knowledge becomes possible if there's an real external world and a real person who somehow is in touch with it. That's within Western philosophy. So for the Yogacara thinkers, like as for the phenomenologists, this the first discovery one makes when one questions one's assumptions in this kind of way, and it's a discovery which changes everything, is that everything in experience is an appearance to consciousness and in consciousness. It's actually impossible to conceive of any experience which isn't an appearance to consciousness of some kind of content. So by consciousness, we don't mean the power of thought conceived as dependent on the brain, which you might be like a working assumption. What we mean is the quality of awareness, which is to say the presence of phenomena, without which experience would be completely unthinkable. It's just worth thinking about that, isn't it? What is consciousness? So Vasubandhu develops a way of conceptualising the way the world comes into being, the way the self and the world comes into being, as we ordinarily know it. So the 30 verses begins with setting out some basic terms. He says, the figurative expressions, self and phenomena, which function in various ways, are the transformations of consciousness. The figurative expressions, self and phenomena, which function in various ways, are the transformations of consciousness. So that's to say, what we experience as subjectivity, as a self, an Atman, and the objective world, with its objects, dharmas, are transformations of the consciousness, which later he goes on to explain as call awareness, jnana, which is the non-dual sort of basis of everything. So these transformations have got three aspects. Firstly, consciousness manifests a transformation into the Siddhor consciousness, the Alaya Vijnana, which is a repository of past actions which are unconsciously appropriated. So consciousness, being what it is, as Silivana Spalding explained, is always accompanied by a sense of mindness, yeah, a kind of first-person stance. Maybe that's a better way to put it. Consciousness is always accompanied by a first-person stance. From this first-person position, I have a point of view on the world. So through beginningless ignorance, there's a consciousness which is, as it were, a store of all my past actions, which continually ripen through the power of karma, to use that kind of Buddhist belief without going into it too much, as kind of contents. So these traces or impressions. I think actually it makes sense to think of, you could instead of talking about karma, you could think about narratives. You could think that the store consciousness is like a narrative consciousness. Your embeddedness in all sorts of narratives that you didn't choose, that you just find yourselves in them. That works better for me than talking about karma. It makes a little bit more Western sense. And those narratives are, by definition, the point of view you take on your experience in the deepest way. And so you experience this alaya vijnana, this store consciousness, as your own. Actually, it's simply the ongoing individualized stream of representations that make up the appearances of the self and the world. It's attended by various universal mental events that have to go along with all experiences. Contact, attention. We don't have experience without attending to something. Awareness, perception, and intention. Based on this store consciousness manifests the second transformation of consciousness, the mind, the manas, which is based on this store and has the characteristics of thinking. So the thinking mind, there's a kind of phenomenological appeal here to ordinary experience of what it is to be conscious. If we take our attention to what it's like to be a self, to be conscious, we notice that we tend to identify with our thinking. So whatever thinking is going on, we tend to think of it as mine. In fact, if we don't, it appears as thought insertions, as somebody else's thoughts. And this is an extremely disturbing, of course, aspect of psychotic experience, I guess. I've never had it, but just one can imagine. I've got friends who've had. To the extent this thinking activity is based on our unconscious appropriation of karma or narratives, this thinking is just experienced as ours. We just this is us thinking. Yeah, we are our thinking. And so this manas, this thinking mind, is afflicted by the store consciousness, the store of stuff. It's continually defiled and afflicted by all the stuff that's arising from it, which you have to think of as your own. And it manifests as, according to Vasubandhu, as self-view, self-delusion, self-conceit and self-love. So all these ordinary experiences crop up through our identification with thoughts. And this mind is called the afflicted mind consciousness by the Yogacharins. It's not permanent in our experience. It can cease during meditation, I guess during sleep and so on, to some extent. Certainly during meditation. Now the third transformation of consciousness are the six sense consciousnesses. So contact between consciousness and what it contacts in the through the sense organs and through the mind gives rise to the experience of a world of objects and a world of thoughts, actually, or imaginings or memories. And Vasubandhu goes through all the wholesome and unwholesome mental events which are familiar from the Abhidharma tradition. So these are all experienced to the extent that the mind is transformed into a self that encounters a world. There's love and hate, confusion and clarity, laziness and energy and so on. He makes the point, though, that the five consciousnesses come into existence according to causes, either together or not, upon the root consciousness like waves upon water. This is a favourite sort of Yogacara metaphor, the contents of awareness arising like waves upon water. They look separate and different from the water, but really they're the same thing. So the everyday self arises in the following way. The word self is a kind of metaphor, a way of naming a certain kind of experience, appearance in consciousness. We saw this argument to some extent made by the Buddha. What appears is the sense of mindness of conscious experience based on the unconscious appropriation of past actions or past narratives in the store, supported by the constant stream of ripenings or new events, you could say. There's a thinking mind which, unbeknownst to its own thinking and prior to paying any conscious attention, takes for granted a kind of minimal sense of self belonging to this appropriative activity of the store. And on the basis of this pre-attentive sense of self, based on appropriation, the mind proliferates the inner content of our representation of a self in terms of self-love, self-delusion, self-conceit, and self-view. But, Vasubandhu says, this is all the results of the transformations of consciousness. In truth, this threefold transformation of consciousness is the imagination of duality. What is imagined by it does not exist. Therefore, all this is representation only. This is it's quite a complicated argument, isn't it? But there's a lot of appeal to a kind of phenomenology of experience going on. And in the second half of the 30 verses, Vasubandhu traces how this sense of self arises from non-dual awareness. So non-dual awareness becomes a way of talking about what you're trying to discover, as it were, through meditation and Dharma practice. In the treatise on the three natures, Vasubandhu uses the metaphor of a conjuring trick or a spell by which an elephant is conjured up by a magician, and compares this to the appearance of the imagined nature of things. But if you think about this, what appears is imagined. What's really there is dependent on the wood and the spells. Yeah? And the real nature of what appears as an elephant is to completely lack any intrinsic existence. The elephant completely doesn't exist, but it arises from wood and spells. So our experiential self is our tendency to believe in what is arising from the store which is like a kind of spell, you could say. Under the influence of the spell, what is actually there, the stuff of consciousness, which is comparable to something impersonal like wood, it appears in the form of a big beast, which is me. This self is the assumption that the duality of subject and object is as real as an illusory elephant. So according to Vasubandhu, therefore, the experiential self is a mistake, an erroneous imagining of a person on the subjective side of this subject-object duality. And the mistake is convincing and inevitable, given the underlying tendency of mind to undergo transformations into the store, the mind, and the six sense consciousnesses. So there's no question of undoing this mistake through philosophical argument, through the chariot argument. It's not going to work, is it? You can only undo it through very deep insight and in meditation. So it's a very deep-rooted mistake. That's Vasubandhu's conclusion, as it were. I thought this might happen. All this is very interesting. And now I get on to Chandrakirti. And you're all probably thinking that's quite enough, actually. Absolutely, probably too much. So I'm going to have to just carry on. And see how you get on. Maybe you'll phase out, or maybe it'll be just the thing. So you can certainly admire the subtlety with which Vasubandhu has built up this sophisticated kind of explanation of the process by which the self operates, and how it can be seen as a mistake. So he certainly doesn't deny the self in a crude or unthinking way. The denial of the self is his argument that it's a mistake or error. But actually, when one thinks about what Vasubandhu's method has amounted to, it's not exactly straightforward to suppose that our extraordinary experience of being a self is can be completely summed up in terms of the transformations of consciousness. If I was to say to Dirika, "Hey, how are the transformations of your consciousness?" Yeah.
Well,
the conversation that we might have about that would be highly theoretical, would it not? Yeah, that's right. So the phenomenology of experience that Vasubandhu does is a highly theoretical construction which explains ordinary experience to the extent that you're convinced by it. So in a way, it's a kind of story, isn't it? Or rather, perhaps it's a philosophical account. So it wouldn't quite work to say it's a story or it's a myth, but it's a model. Does that work? It's a model. So you have to accept the model for it to make sense that the self is an error. We turn now to Chandrakirti, the Madhyamaka, and his basic approach of the middle way school is to not set up models. As soon as you set up a model, you set up a sort of fiction, which is going to just distract you from looking at directly at your experience. That was what we were interested in.
Right,
of course, yeah.
Chandrakirti,
which I suppose means as famous as the moon. It's his name. What a great name. Following Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti doesn't make any assumptions. He simply takes for granted what other people, what everybody takes for granted. That's his sole method. And for Buddhists, what you take for granted, as it were, in your approach, would be an acceptance of dependent arising. So you'd be interested in dependent arising. Perhaps you've noticed how dependent arising works in your experience. Just because of dependent arising, there's a distinction to be made between the conventional and ultimate truth. When we ask, well, what is the self really? We're asking about its ultimate truth. But if we consider that things are dependently arisen, this question turns out to mean to be a difficult one. According to the Abhidharma, the ultimate truth of experience was that it is constituted by the aggregates, the constituents. It's made of lots of bits and pieces, none of which are the self. So the appeal to the ultimate truth in the Abhidharma was to a number of really existing kind of elements, consciousness and the body and so on, which kind of interact through dependent arising. But these Marjyamikas, they think that's a method or a model as well. You can't just assume these dharmas exist. Let's not assume anything. Then the very appearance of ultimate truth depends on conditions. It depends on conventional truth, what appears through ordinary ways of talking about things. And the this means that for Nagarjuna, I'll just quote from the Mulamajamka Karika, the ultimate is not taught without recourse to the customary. Without understanding the ultimate, nirvana is not achieved. So this is a point of view that all it takes for granted is dependent arising, really. The ultimate nature of things, the ultimate truth, can't be achieved without recourse to the language and concepts which we just normally use, which we know to be dependently arisen on various ways. But without understanding the ultimate, without understanding what is the truth in an ultimate sense, nirvana is not achieved. So it's dialectical in as much as he just uses the concepts and ideas that we take for granted and then throws them back at you to think of them in a different way. So it turns out that the ultimate truth is that things are dependently arisen, meaning they are empty of ultimate intrinsic existence. So similarly, what we can know ultimately is only that our knowledge depends on ordinary concepts. So it's only in dependence on our investigation of ordinary experience that we can come to a nirvana. That's really probably a very dubious summary of Marjyamika, but it's to get you started. So I mentioned earlier how Chandrakirti uses this kind of method in relation to the chariot argument. He just brings up some very good points about the assumptions that is made and points out that the chariot argument doesn't work and it won't help. So he does the same thing really in relation to much more sophisticated arguments from other Buddhists. He makes the point that the self must be either the same as the five constituents or different from them. The non-Buddhist philosophers often say that the self is different from the constituents. It's a sort of robust self that is perhaps identified with universal spirit. Or the Cartesian sort of substance that doesn't belong to that's quite separate from the physical world. So really that's not going to be an option for Buddhist philosophers. So the other option is that the constituents are the same as the self is the same as the constituents. Our ordinary experience of being a self must in some sense be completely the same as the five constituents. But various problems arise with this. Basically, if there's five constituents, you end up with five selves. You can't really get to the experience of being a single unique person and point of view on the world through considering the plurality of the constituents. The breakthrough comes, though, by just noticing that the self actually is perhaps neither the same as the constituents nor different, but it's dependently arisen. So here we have a simple appeal to basic Buddhist teaching. If that's the case, if the self is dependently arisen, therefore the basis of ego identification, the basis of the ahankara, is not a thing, nor is it other than the constituents, nor is it the stuff of the constituents. So it's not apart from the constituents, it's not the same as the constituents. Nor is it the support of the constituents, nor does it possess the constituents, but it is established that it carries on by means of the constituents. Can't really deny this, can you? The self appears to us in ordinary experience in a manner which is just like the way that a chariot appears from the way that its parts are quite evident in our experience. You could say a chair, you know. A chair appears to us as a chair, which you can quite easily call a chair, and it has a certain kind of existence. But when you look at it, it's simply a construction of various parts. So the self appears in a manner which is just like this. In ordinary everyday experience, we appear to ourselves as a unique first-person perspective, continuous through time. Then, and Chandrakirti says, the self is that which continually manifests to people, in which there is always the conviction of ego identification. And that in which its perception of identifying with what is mine arises through confusion and from a lack of intelligent investigation. So, what it is to be a self, which amounts to the perception of identifying with what is mine, is something that arises through confusion and from a lack of intelligent investigation. So, certainly the self appears, but when I investigate the basis for this conventional existence, relaxing the unquestioning ego identification of ordinary life, I find that ultimately this self doesn't exist by itself, but only in dependence on its various conditions. There's no need on this account to explain the appearance of the self by reducing it to something more truly real, like non-dual awareness, from which it's supposed to arise. What's denied here is just that the self exists in the manner that it appears, which is to say, as existing apart from its causes and conditions. So quite normally, we experience ourselves as somehow existing apart from the causes and conditions that we arise from. The ego, through ego identification, we think, we have, very directly, not by thinking, have the sense of mindness, of this experience is mine. I am a first-person point of view on the world. That's how it appears. But by investigating it, we see that how this appears is the product of not investigating it very clearly. that not really understanding what's going on. What appears is my experiential self that appears to exist independently, but how I appear is on the basis of causes and conditions. So the ultimate truth about me is that my ordinary everyday self and its way of identifying itself as such are all I am. Discovering this, however, is the beginning of letting go of the pervasive belief that I exist as I think I do. And that simple discovery suffices, according to Chandrakirti, for the entire project of denying the self and having the perception of not self. So I think Chandrakirti's got it right, because he's shown that the chariot argument might be unhelpful, that a reductionist argument doesn't work very well, and that the denial of the self by Vasubandhu in terms of a elaborate model, phenomenological model of consciousness, is not necessary and is artificial. Just by investigating the way the self appears, one can notice the difference between what appears and how it appears. And I think Chandrakirti's got it right because, well, another reason for supposing it might be right is that this very nicely explains how the Buddha put it. Yeah? So the Buddha led his followers to look closely into the experience, discover the perception of not-self, but then he was completely able to use pronouns and inhabit a first-person stance just like everybody else. Yeah. So the Chandrakirti makes it completely intelligible how the Buddha expresses himself in ordinary speech without taking it literally. Got to stop, that's too... Yeah. Thanks very much. That was a little bit long.